Hello, fellow rebel capitalists. Hope you're well. I am right here with my good buddy live, the man himself, Jeff Snyder. Jeff, thanks for coming on the show, buddy.
Hey, George. Good afternoon. Hope everything's good with you. Thank you for having me.
It is. It is. I was at Rebel Capitalists Live this weekend, and SOFR and LIBOR came up quite a bit. Believe it or not.
I don't believe that for a second. I think you're making that completely up.
No, I'm serious. I'm actually serious. And so I wanted to get you on to kind of think that through, because I understand what SOFR is. I understand what LIBOR is, but I don't really fully understand the transition. And the last time I heard you talk about this with Emil, if my memory serves, and maybe the last time we talked about it, you said that the banks really weren't using SOFR, and the Fed has tried to get them to make this transition for, I don't know, 8 years or something like that. And you said that they just weren't doing it, no matter how much the Fed cries wolf and says, you better do it. They're still doing it in practice. And I think one of the reasons you said was because SOFR didn't have a term structure. So I wanted to kind of figure out what that is, why that's important. But then I was talking to some of the members of our mastermind group at this event, and a lot of them are heavy into real estate. They're like Kenny McElroy, where they're doing really big deals and apartment complexes and whatnot. And they said that their loans now, as of, what was it, Josh, the last month or so, or last couple months? Yeah, they said that every single one of their banks is saying that they are switching over to SOFR. And so I just kind of wanted to get your views on that, just kind of get into more detail about the term structure. And if you think they're going to make the transition, just get your thoughts.
Well, there's a lot packed up in there. And the fact that you know anything about SOFR versus LIBOR means that you're way ahead of central bankers and officials, because it's clear by forcing this transition, they don't really have a whole lot of appreciation. And we should probably back up and say, why are they forcing this to begin with? Now, you got to go all the way back almost an entire decade to what they called at the time the crime of the century, which was the LIBOR fixing scandal. And essentially, they blew that way out of proportion because they don't like LIBOR. So the official thing is, you know, a bunch of bankers, you know, figure out, first of all, what is LIBOR? LIBOR is an own rate, which means that banks get together. Usually it used to be through the British Bankers Association. And they sit around a coffee table, a virtual conference room, you know, a conference call in the morning and say, what rate would you be able to borrow unsecured in the market today?
Yeah, they'd literally just call them on the phone, wouldn't they?
Right. So they just have this conference call. They bang out, and all the banks that participate in the survey, they throw out the high, they throw out the low, and they come up with a median. And there you go. There's your LIBOR in various tenors across the structure. So essentially, LIBOR was always an interbank opinion. Right. So of course, there's going to be leeway in how bankers do things. Now, that doesn't mean that there wasn't some kind of rigging involved, or there wasn't a legitimate scandal to be uncovered there, because yes, there was some of that stuff, but it was blown way out of proportion. And while we don't condone what the bankers were doing, it didn't really change the LIBOR rates at all. And it wasn't some massive scandal or massive crime that, you know, that stole nickels from grandma's pocketbook. It was simply in this quirk of interbank finance that supports and underpins basically everything that's in fixed income around the world. And I think what really happened here is, in my own personal opinion, and of course you'll never have officials or politicians or central bankers will never admit this, they don't like LIBOR because of what it actually is. What does LIBOR stand for? The London Interbank Offered Rate. London. Why are we using this standard London Interbank Offered Rate for U.S. dollars for commerce all around the world? Well, right. If you know anything about the futures markets, it's tied to LIBOR. They're called Eurodollar futures. So LIBOR is essentially a Eurodollar rate, which, as we've talked about before, doesn't officially exist in the approved or conventional language. So we have this massive, you know, set of benchmark interest rates that support the entire, you know, global financial community that is set and focused on the Eurodollar system, not the domestic system where everybody's taught to believe the Fed is in charge, but this Eurodollar system, the London Interbank Offer Rate, offshore money, offshore dollars. And furthermore, if you go back in 2007 and 2008, it was the LIBOR rates, the offshore rates, that told you, no matter what the Fed did, there was still a crisis, and the crisis was getting larger. Because if you recall, LIBOR spreads were blowing out, and they stayed fat throughout the entire crisis, no matter what the Fed did in terms of its programs or the size of its balance sheet. So not only do we have this offshore U.S. dollar benchmark, it was also the same thing that if you were paying attention back in 2008, 2009, and 2007, that showed the world there was a problem and the Federal Reserve was never able to fix it.
Right. So it was a red flag. It was this canary in the coal mine.
Yeah. I mean, people heard about the TED spread, but they don't really understand what the TED spread is. It's a euro dollar spread. It's a credit spread that tells you about liquidity risks in the global dollar market. And so Ben Bernanke, you know, Janet Yellen, Jay Powell, everybody who's come after him, do you really want this major offshore outside our control rate to support and underpin the entire global financial system? I mean, eventually people might start to ask questions. Why are we looking at this offshore US dollar rate? And why does it oftentimes, including March of 2020, why does it oftentimes picture the Federal Reserve as an incompetent group of bureaucrats? So the animus toward LIBOR has much less to do with the crime of the century that has long since been forgotten about, and more to do with trying to retain this mystique behind the Fed being a central bank, therefore denying or even just completely erasing this offshore history, this offshore location.
So, yeah, the Wizard of Oz doesn't want us to pull back the curtain.
No, and LIBOR isn't just, I mean, if you sit and think about it, George, LIBOR is essentially hiding in plain sight. I mean, people talk about it. They actually, you know, understand what it is or have heard about it in some way, shape, or form. But yet nobody ever stops and thinks, hey, London, why are we talking about London? This is US dollars. Why is it London? And so it's been out there in plain sight ever since it came about in 1969. All the time, it's offshore US dollars. It's just that nobody ever stops and thinks about the next step of it is, okay, why are we dealing with offshore? And why is it that LIBOR tends to show up when in the most inconvenient times for the Federal Reserve? So
what
you
did
can
we
see
use as a bench rate prior to 1969?
There was none. I mean, this is all brand new stuff. And, you know, the story behind LIBOR in 1969, actually, it's the Shah of Iran. The Iranians actually in 1968 had experienced such a massive dollar shortage, they had to borrow about $32 million from the IMF, which back then was an enormous sum. I mean, today it sounds like pocket change. But so, you know, some bankers in London got together and said, we'll lend you money, but we just need to come up with an interest rate. And so he got a bunch of bankers together that were already operating in this euro dollar market and said, we'll come up with a standardized benchmark rate. And this is 1969. The guy was known as the Greek for manufacturers at Hanover, and said, we'll benchmark and we'll standardize this offshore dollar borrowing so that this euro dollar market can really take off, as it did. So there was no real benchmark before then. And so LIBOR has been in place since the late 60s as a familiar, predictable benchmark that tells us a lot about what's going on, where it actually matters. The Eurodollar market, not the Fed, the Eurodollar system.
Right. So then SOFR, let's explain that. That's basically a rate that is derived from repo transactions in the actual marketplace, which is how they're pitching it. I mean, that's how they're selling it. Instead of just calling up bankers, this is a real interest rate based on transactions that are occurring between financial institutions in the real world.
So already you can tell they're off the rails, because LIBOR is an unsecured rate. Remember, it's just bankers saying what would be able to borrow unsecured tomorrow for 3 months,
and
whatever.
Repo's secured, right.
Right, and so the Fed says, we got to get rid of LIBOR. It's all this Eurodollar stuff. We don't want people paying attention to Eurodollar, but we got to replace it with something. What do we replace it with? Well, let's replace it with another unsecured rate. Oh, well, there isn't one. Right. All that there is federal funds, and in the post-crisis era, unsecured markets have essentially dried up. So making the argument that this was a fake rate, or, you know, LIBOR was a made up rate, it's not based on actual transactions, it's what banks' opinions are about what they could be able to borrow with on any given day. Their only option left was a repo rate, because that's really where all the volume and transactions were. And this is really one key area where there's been so much problem. Why SOFR adoption has been so slow is because the secured overnight financing rate, SOFR, is a repo rate. And repo is not the same as unsecured. It's secured by collateral. And so already we're moving in a different direction than the market wants. The market wants an unsecured rate because that gives market participants some idea of liquidity and credit risk, because it is an unsecured rate. We're getting an interpretation of the market participants telling us what they feel is especially liquidity risk. And that's why it was so valuable in 2007 and 2008. And it wouldn't have been if it was a SOFR-based system, because SOFR is secured by collateral, and therefore it's not the same thing at all. And then the second primary difference is that it's an overnight rate, secured overnight financing rate. So it's an overnight repo rate. It has no inherent term structure, which a term structure simply means if you want to borrow and repo at SOFR, that's the rate you're going to get overnight. But how much would you charge, or how much would you expect to borrow if you want to borrow funds for 3 months, a term rate, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not the same saying that, well, we'll just use the market to sort of predict what the standard overnight rate will be in 3 months. That's a very different thing, because a term structure tells us about, again, risk, right? Because you're essentially putting together all the risks that you can think of. If I lend to you overnight, the risks are probably minimal. But if I lend to you over a 3 or 6 month term, there's more uncertainty over that longer period of time. It's not just the standard overnight rate bootstrapped from one day after another. There's a time factor involved when you're starting from today and thinking into the future. All the things that could possibly go wrong in the future, those things pile up.
So, how is that term structure set up with LIBOR? I'm assuming that the overnight rate is the phone call, but then there's some sort of marketplace that would
it's the same phone call. So the British Bankers Association, and then eventually the Intercontinental Exchange, got involved after the scandal, where the bankers on the conference call say, if I were going to lend overnight, this is the rate I would probably get. If I wanted to borrow at a 3 month rate or a 3 month term, this is the rate that I would get. If I wanted to borrow at a 6 month term. And so there are all these different LIBOR benchmarks. The one that's used most frequently is 3 month LIBOR, because that's tied to Eurodollar futures, and it's the standard benchmark. So that's saying, if I wanted to borrow funds today for 3 months, what would my cost be today? It's not the same thing as saying, what would the overnight rate be in 3 months? That's looking backwards from 3 months, whereas we're looking forward from now for a term of 3 months. Now, what has happened is that, number one, when they pushed SOFR on the market starting in 2014 with the Alternative Reference Rate Committee, they said, well, a term structure for SOFR will naturally develop. Again, it's still not the same thing, but what they were expecting to happen were these SOFR futures to trade on the Chicago Exchange, they have. And then they would be able to bootstrap, essentially extrapolate an implied term structure from SOFR from these futures, which is kind of what they've done. But when you map out SOFR, implied SOFR term structure against term LIBOR, for example, they don't match up. And in some cases, they don't match up very well at all, because, again, they're two very different things. And there's also concerns about whether or not there's actually sufficient liquidity in the Chicago Exchange to create a rational enough or reasonable or predictable enough term structure for SOFR either. So you have all of these things that are very different. You have LIBOR, which is unsecured, therefore it has inherent risk, liquidity, and credit risk embedded in the rates, versus SOFR, which doesn't. LIBOR, which has a natural term structure because it's polling banks about what would they be able to borrow at different terms and different tenors, whereas SOFR has no term structure, and we're sort of backing it out of a futures market that really isn't all that great and hasn't established much proficiency in being able to implement the same thing. So you wonder why banks have been very slow to adopt and change from LIBOR. This is the reason. There's a tremendous amount of uncertainty involved switching from one to the other. Yet, but because officials and central banks, in particular regulators, have made such a big deal out of it, because they have committed to doing this, there was really no way for them to really step back and say, well, we can't stop now. It's sort of like institutional inertia. We've made LIBOR into the crime of the century. We got to get rid of this thing, even though the replacement that we've come up with is unsuited in these very fundamental ways.
What are the risks that you see in this transition that the central planners and the central bankers don't see?
Well, to your earlier point, George, this transition is happening, because what happened at the end of last year was the new LIBOR loans weren't forbidden. But what the regulators said was, starting January 1st of 2022, if you write a loan with anybody, that has LIBOR as a reference rate, we're going to treat you very differently. We're going to treat you in very harsh terms. And if something goes wrong with that loan, we're basically going to put you out of business. We're going to jack up the rates of everything.
It's like being unvaccinated.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. That's exactly it. We're going to make life so uncomfortable for you, you won't like it. And so banks said, what actually happened was in November and December, there was an absolute flood of LIBOR benchmark loans to get in ahead of that deadline because everybody still wanted the LIBOR. And since then, in transition through December and into January so far, what I've heard is exactly what you've heard. A lot of banks have turned to term SOFR and sort of, you know, fingers crossed that it'll perform in the way we want it to. And there's still a lot of other issues involved there as well. Other banks have turned to something called BSBY, which is a rate that Bloomberg has come up with. Still others have used something called AmeriRIBOR, which is something that the American Exchange has put out. And I believe there's another alternative rate that's been floated around too that maybe hasn't got a lot of traction, but maybe over time. So officials have said, what they started out saying is that you have to use SOFR. You got to use SOFR. And then as nobody did, and then as the term SOFR structure in the futures market didn't really take off, they softened last year in particular and said, okay, you can't use LIBOR, but if you don't use SOFR, you have to justify what it is you're using, which has led to this BSBY, which has led to AmeriRIBOR and other interest rates. So it isn't strictly SOFR, but definitely LIBOR is taking a step back because regulators needed to bring this thing to a conclusion after bashing it for so long and being so intent on making sure it doesn't get used or doesn't come out there in the public anymore. They had to get rid of it some way.
Do you think the Fed believes they can control that rate better if it's based on repo transactions? And I'm just, these are their words, not mine. And they say, okay, well, we've got this standing repo facility. So we're kind of back, you know, they go back to 2019, to September. It's okay, we don't want that to happen again. So let's just make this standing repo facility permanent. And then what we'll do is we're not worried about liquidity or cash, if that was the problem. And then they're saying, okay, so we're backstopping repo, and then we'll peg a rate to the repo transactions. So then we can better micromanage this bench rate that is used globally.
No, that's not really happening at all. And I don't think anybody at the Fed would actually believe that. I mean, they might say that or make the implication. But if you go back to September of 2019, that was not what happened at all. In fact, what that demonstrated is that at specific times, the repo rate is actually more volatile than LIBOR would be. And so it actually raises the risk that maybe the repo rate comes back to bite the Fed in some ways because they're using a different rate. But that's not really what the credit markets globally aren't really concerned about the Fed's management of manipulation of interest rates. What they're really focused on and why they like LIBOR so much is that because they know what it means. They know what goes on in it. It tells them what they want to know so that they can price loan products that don't lead them into massive losses. You don't know that's going to be the same because we really don't know how SOFR, especially term SOFR, is going to behave under stress because we've never seen it before. And again, term SOFR is essentially backing out of reverse engineering a term structure out of a futures market that hasn't been tested either. So we don't really know how SOFR might stand up to any sort of pressure because we've never seen it before. Whereas Eurodollar futures and LIBOR rates, we know how these react. We know what to expect from them. They know what information they're telling us because we've been getting that information for, you know, more than 50 years already. We know what's going on there. And then being forced into this really bastardized, other, you know, inappropriate, unsuitable SOFR rate leaves a lot of uncertainty on the table, which, if you know anything about fixed income, is exactly the one thing that fixed income markets hate the most, is that kind of unpredictability, uncertainty. The only downside is they really don't have much of a choice at this point. You know, in one sense, I think what a lot of market participants had done up until the deadline at the end of last year was they were hoping one of these other rates would come out as a winner. One, you know, BSBY or AmeriRIBOR or even term SOFR would prove itself as the best successor to LIBOR. And none of them actually did. And so it's sort of like last minute scramble. What do we do now? I mean, we got to do something. So Term Software, we'll see if that works. We'll try BSBY, and I think we'll try some of the other ones. And maybe a Clear Leader will show itself at some point this year, but so far it really hasn't.
You know what I'm thinking as you're saying that, Jeff, is we've got this euro dollar problem, or the euro dollar market is broken. And we definitely know that the euro dollar market is far more risk averse, to the detriment maybe of the global economy, than it was, let's say, in the early 2000s. So now all of a sudden what you're doing is you're going to this marketplace that we need for global dollar liquidity. And you're giving them a reason to be even more risk averse, which would lead me to believe that they'll be less likely to provide that dollar liquidity that the global economy actually needs moving forward. Is there something there?
I think so. And I think that's the overriding issue. You're right, Joe. I mean, you're absolutely right. If they had done this, say, in 1998, there might not have been any pushback at all. Everybody would have said, just give us a rate. We're just booking loans. We don't really give a shit. We don't care. Let's just give us whatever it is. Nowadays, they micromanage every little risk detail because that's really the environment that we're in. We're in the post-crisis era where everybody realizes the Fed isn't really a central bank, that you're really on your own island as far as survival and liquidity is concerned. Therefore, it's not just about interbank markets borrowing dollars in these very complex ways in these offshore markets. It's about pricing credit and even what happens to the credit after it gets priced. Who owns it? Who wants to own it? Are we going to shove it on a balance sheet somewhere? Are we going to pawn it off on insurance companies or pension funds? Are we going to be able to? You're right. The whole issue is risk aversion, and it's sort of an unforced error where regulators and officials have decided to introduce this massive uncertainty that the market for years pushed back on and said, this is wrong. You're doing the wrong thing. We don't want to do this. We don't care about LIBOR fixing scandal. If you don't like LIBOR, fine, then provide us with a replacement that gives us the same sort of information. And that's really the big uncertainty. It's an unforced error that shows you both the arrogance and incompetence of officials. And it's something that markets, more so now than ever, they just inherently cannot stand that degree of uncertainty.
Yeah,
it's not enough to say, hey, maybe someday Term SOFR will prove itself, but between now and then, we're going to risk hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars in tranched and syndicated loans on an unproven, unsuitable index?
Yeah, and when you're using the word uncertainty, as a former entrepreneur, if you want to call me that, the thing that comes to my mind, you're saying that the bankers don't like uncertainty, or the bond market doesn't like, fixed income doesn't like uncertainty, nor do entrepreneurs at all. And so if I'm just thinking through this, looking at it through the lens of an entrepreneur, if our objective is for entrepreneurs to create more stuff, that's how we get economic growth. Just like our objective is for the euro dollar market banks to lend more freely in a prudent way, that would be, the example of an entrepreneur creating more stuff. If you come in and burden an entrepreneur with regulations and these change all the time, and if you introduce more uncertainty into a free market capitalist system, you're going to get less stuff. The entrepreneurs are going to be creating fewer goods and services. So that's kind of how I see it, looking at it, looking at the euro dollar banking system in a similar way when you introduce that uncertainty.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the main takeaway. Forget all the complications, because there's even more stuff that we even talked about, fallback provisions and all sorts of other stuff, because Eurodollar futures are still linked to three-month LIBOR, and some of the major LIBOR terms are going to last for another 18 months. They're still pricing old LIBOR loans in LIBOR, at least scheduled for until June 30th of next year. So LIBOR is still around, you can't make new loan products in LIBOR. So it's uncertainty, Forget the details for a moment. You're right. It's what this really is about uncertainty. And to be clear, it's not about short run uncertainty. It's about more longer run uncertainty, because so far, people I've talked to, my own anecdotal research and things like that, it hasn't created some sort of rift in the markets today or January 1st. Everything is still getting done, but you can tell there's a degree of worry and angst. And where it really becomes a problem is if things start to go in the wrong direction. If we have another bout of illiquidity, does the market say, ooh, we're not really sure about the software information that we're given? Do we pull back? Does it become pro-cyclical, which is the exact opposite of what they're really trying to achieve here? And so that's where the uncertainty really plays in, because not only is that in the back of everybody's mind as they're participating in these markets using a benchmark rate that they're not familiar with, even if it's something like BSBY, we still don't really know a hell of a lot about it. I mean, we can break it apart. I'm sure Bloomberg has done a great job of presenting what's in it and how it's supposed to work theoretically, but there's still a lot of uncertainty about that. So that's in the back of everybody's mind. And if push starts to come to shove again at some point, does the market say, we're just too uncertain about what these benchmarks are doing or what we expect them to do, or they're doing something we don't expect them to do? And then that creates the credit problem down the road. So that's really the problem.
Yeah, what I'd like to think through with you, Jeff, maybe to illustrate your point to the audience, is let's go back to the GFC or early 2008, or maybe prior to March of 2020. Let's just go, let's say January of 2020, and say, what if they would have made the SOFR switch then? So you're layering over a financial crisis on top of this uncertainty that we're referring to. Would the GFC have been even worse, do you think? Or would March of 2020 been even worse? Would there have been far more risk there? Or how do you see that?
Well, I think the official interpretation is that it would have been better. Because if you remember back to 2000, or even March 2020, but if you go back to 2007, 2008, the repo rate, back then the GC repo rate, there was no SOFR, but the GC repo rate actually was shallow like federal funds and actually followed T-bills. So they went low while LIBOR went high. Now you can interpret that one of two ways, and only one of which is correct. The official interpretation, the wrong one, would be that the market would have said, oh, nothing wrong here, everything's great. And so the crisis, maybe it would still happen, but it would have been less because nobody was following this major crisis signal. They would have been reassured by low rates in the short run. And I don't think that's true at all, because I don't think market participants are that stupid. So in reality, what that would have done was that it made it more difficult, because then market participants who knew that the system was failing and didn't have the LIBOR signal at that time would have looked for it and found it in someplace else, which would have contributed exactly what we're talking about, because they would have said, oh my God, short-term rates are not behaving in the way that matches reality. Therefore, we're just going to give up we're going to pull the plug on everything.
Right.
So it might've been actually worse. So LIBOR in a lot of ways is certainly in the first part of the crisis was, hey, something is very wrong here, where short-term rates were actually signaling the same thing, but from a different angle and from a different interpretation. But the LIBOR signal was a very profound signal that told people in a very obvious way what was wrong, how much it was wrong. And so if officials had followed the LIBOR rate instead of trying to move the market in the ways that they wanted to, they might have actually sought how to fix the problem instead of trying to dismiss LIBOR as some kind of dysfunctional rate that nobody should pay attention to. They might have done much better had they actually heeded the message embedded within it, which is the same message the market wants to see going forward. And so, that's the uncertainty. Same thing with March of 2020. What you saw was the repo rates did something very different than LIBOR did for actually the same reasons, because there was a surplus of cash in a small part of the system and a huge deficit of cash throughout the most vast majority of it. So the LIBOR signal told you that something was very wrong liquidity-wise throughout the global marketplace, which then manifested in a broken treasury market as foreign reserve managers tried to sell the reserve assets in mass. So without that LIBOR signal, all you see is, oh, the treasury market must be broken. Maybe we should fix the treasury market, instead of realize that there was a massive dollar shortage out there that LIBOR easily identified from the very start.
Yeah, it's like for people to imagine, if you're an entrepreneur or just someone in daily living, if you've got a routine or a system or a tool that you use to fix problems that you've been using since 1969. So you've been using it for, let's say, 50 years, and we have a crisis situation. Are you going to have more confidence in that situation? Are you going to have more confidence to weather the storm if you have that tool, or if that tool was just replaced 2 months ago? That's really what we're talking about here. So,
yeah, and I think, George, I think it goes along with what the officials and regulators are banking on, is that we won't have any problems for, say, the next 10 years. And therefore, during that 10-year run, SOFR and term SOFR, all these things, if there's any kinks left in them, they'll get worked out and everybody will become comfortable with them. No big deal. but are you willing to bet hundreds of trillions in derivatives and fixed income products around the world that nothing is going to happen over the next 10 years when we've had one problem after another over the past 15 years where LIBOR has been helpful in sorting those out too? I think it's not just, you know, being wrong. It's self-delusion. It really is. It's the idea that, hey, let's focus on getting rid of LIBOR so we don't spill the beans that there's a global dollar system and that's really what's important. And then it creates all these knock-on effects that, again, that's why it's 2022 and it's been almost 10 years and we're still talking about LIBOR uncertainty.
Yeah, right. Let's now talk about something that's happening that I know is on your radar, and that's the 10-year Treasury yield going from, I think, 1.4 to maybe 1.75 roughly in like the last, I don't know, the last month, something like that.
That's a big move. Yeah, it was 180 there intraday.
Oh, today is 180?
Not today, but earlier. I think it was earlier this week. It was above 180.
Yeah, and that's a big move. And I know I've spoken to you about this a lot as far as deflation, inflation, and just really looking at that as though it's global economic output. And you use that long end of the curve to tell you whether or not global economic output or whether the market foresees global economic output increasing or decreasing. In other words, if the 10-year treasury is going down, that's giving you a signal saying that in the future, economic activity will probably be lower and then vice versa. But now, so I was telling you prior to hitting the record button here and just to fill in the audience that yesterday, if you guys watched that video I did and we talked about the 10-year treasury going up, I tried to speculate as to what your view would be, Jeff. And what was funny is this morning I was listening to one of your videos and it was basically the opposite of what I thought. I thought you would see the 10-year going to 1.7 and say, okay, well, the market for some reason is seeing that global economic activity most likely will increase. That's what the rising rates are telling us, basically. And I thought, well, maybe that's the market pricing in this recent variant being the last one that we have and the whole pandemic being in the rear view mirror going into the summer. But your view is the complete opposite. The rising interest rates is the market telling us that we actually may have a decrease in economic activity. Do you want to explain your view?
Yeah, it's not so simple as just, you know, what either or, and rising nominal rates are not just, an individual. You have to take the whole curve shape into account. And I would disagree with you there a little bit, George. I would say that the move from 140, I think it got down to 137 intraday on the low most recently. So what is that? A little bit over 40 basis points. That to me is not a big move whatsoever. That's basically just a market fluctuation. We've seen three of those over the last year. So to me, that wasn't really profound anyway. It certainly didn't signal any kind of major shift in market position. But what we have seen where it is more profound, especially since around August and really September of last year, is that short-term rates are rising. They're rising much more rapidly and much more forcefully, much more than the long end is, which has led to the curve collapse.
But it's still staying within the range, correct? From 0 to 25 basis points. So that 3 month is going up, but it's still staying within that range. Is that correct?
Well, now you're seeing the short end bills go up too. So the entire curve at the front end is steepened because it's anticipating the rate hikes, which the Federal Reserve has essentially announced that it's going to be doing this year. And the market agrees. Yes, the Fed is going to be doing rate hikes and we're pricing in several of those for this year. Okay. But that doesn't mean the Fed is right. That doesn't mean the Fed's reasoning behind its tapering and rate hikes are correct. In fact, that's where the market at the long end is saying, no, Jay, you're wrong. And you're wrong in the same way you were just a couple years ago. Yes, we believe you're going to do rate hikes because you're an idiot. You always do rate hikes when you shouldn't. And so that's where the 10 years lack of move, especially versus the 5-year or the 2-year, the yield curve flattening out so dramatically, is these competing interests coming together.
I see.
So you have, you know, I like how you put it into Omicron. What Jay Powell had said to end 2021 was that the only thing that's going to stop our rate hikes is if Omicron turns out worse than we think it will be. And so when we started 2022 and it looked like Omicron really wasn't that big of a deal at all, what the market said was this was the last hurdle in front of Powell's rate hikes. So the short end immediately moved. Now, the short end moves like that, it can move the long end with it, but the long end doesn't steepen out, which means, you know, it, the long end rates are moving as in tandem with or even faster than short-term rates are rising, which is the long end disagreeing. So, you know, you go back to 2018, for example, from August, September, October, and even into November of 2018, the yield curve was flattening out pretty much in the same way it is now, but nominal rates rose. Remember the 10-year got above 3, you know, I think it got as high as 3.25% in November of 2018. That wasn't the market picturing better growth inflation expectations in moving forward. It was the flattening curve telling you that the Fed is making a major mistake by heightening rates and that pretty soon it was all going to turn around because reality was going to set in on the Fed and they would realize that the reasons and justifications for the rate hikes were all wrong. So that's the part that's repeating here. So even if nominal rates are rising at the 10-year or even out to the 30-year, they're not rising as fast as the short end. In fact, they're being pushed up by those short end rates. And they're resisting the narrative behind the hawkish policies at the Federal Reserve, which is why the curve is flattening out. So it's got the flat curve, not necessarily the rising nominal rates. That's the important part here.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
People really need to pay attention to what that curve looks like, not just get fixated on the 10-year and whether or not that's going up or down.
Yeah, if you watch the 10-year and just look at a chart of the 10-year, you can get a case of, you know, a sort of tunnel vision.
Yeah.
You think that the 10-year moves in isolation. You always need to pay attention to the calendar spreads. To me, the most important one is the difference between the 5-year and the 10-year for these reasons we just said, because it's really in the middle, the belly of the curve where these competing interests collide. And that spread between the 5-year and the 10-year can tell you a lot about these competing interests or these conflict of interest rates and which one is really moving which parts of the curve. And that's the other thing. You got to remember the short end of the yield curve out to the 5-year note, they might be heavily influenced by monetary policy expectations for what monetary policy is going to be. But beyond that, the curve is very independent. It moves in the way it wants to. So if you have conflicting signals, short end rates rising, long-term rates maybe not rising or even falling, that's a very powerful message that you should pay very close attention to.
If I were to say, Jeff, in with 100% certainty, that I came from the future, let's say, and I said the Fed is going to raise rates, let's say 4 or 5 times in the next year and a half, would you say, okay, if they do that, I think that my base case would be the curve would invert?
Yes, I think that's exactly what the market is saying right now today. If the Fed gets far enough that they get 5 or 6 rate hikes, I think you're going to see the curve would be inverted by then, if not before then. Because I think the market is saying already the second half of 2021 was nothing like what everybody said. There was no boom. There was no massive inflation. Yes, consumer prices went up. We don't need to revisit that discussion. But it wasn't because the economy is roaring. As you point out, George, economic activity did not come roaring back. And so the markets have already positioned going into 2022 as if whatever Jay Powell is seeing in the labor market and the unemployment rate, it's the same false signal that he used 3 years ago. The economy, and it's not just the U.S. Let's also be clear about that, too. The U.S. Treasury market is a global signal. It's not just about what's going on in the United States. It's about the entire global economy, the entire global monetary system. And so when you see the U.S. goods economy is good, but the U.S. service economy is not, that's one reason why the curve would flatten out. You look at China. China is slowing down materially. That's going to factor into this flattening in the yield curve too. Look at Europe, Japan, the round emerging markets, all sorts of all these other uncertainties that are out there. And throw in LIBOR and SOFR, because why not? That's another uncertainty. And that would affect, you know, if there's anything that goes wrong there, that would obviously affect growth and inflation potential over the long run. So there's any number of reasons why the long end of the yield curve would behave very differently than the front end. Because Jay Powell's hawkish and the market says, yes, you're going to be right. You're going to be hiking rates, but we believe at some point you're going to regret it and probably turn around.
Can you expand on something I heard you talking about with Emil, where you thought that 10-year, that long end of the curve, could be also going up as a result of these corporations or entities, let's say, selling their treasuries to get the dollars they need to maybe pay off the dollar-denominated debt? I don't know if that's exactly what you were saying, but something to the effect that because the global economy is so bad right now, they're having to sell any dollar-denominated assets they have.
Well, that's, you know, that's the paradox of selling treasuries. Everybody believes, and you've been told, and you probably heard about this all over the mainstream media, the internet, whatever, that foreigners hate treasuries. They're going to blow up the treasury market. Without foreigners, the treasury market would be toast because, you know, we don't save enough inside the United States. Therefore, we, you know, there's no way we could service the U.S. federal government's fiscal deficits without foreign participation. But right. History has shown conclusively, and not just over recent history, this goes back to the very early formation of the Eurodollar system in the 50s and 60s, that when foreigners sell treasuries, they sell treasuries because they're confronted with a dollar shortage. So if you're using a U.S. treasury as a reserve asset and you have a dollar shortage faced by the banks in your local jurisdiction, you have to liquidate your reserve asset to try to provide some of those dollars into the local dollar market.
Right.
So there's this paradoxical, well, it seems like a paradoxical relationship where foreigners sell their treasuries during periods where interest rates on the treasuries fall, which means prices rise, because those are two reactions to the same thing, the dollar shortage. So the dollar shortage causes foreigners to sell their treasuries. At the same time, it causes the rest of the marketplace to demand treasuries for their safety and liquidity characteristics. Yeah, so what I was telling Emil and what Emil and I were talking about was that the historical relationship is very clear. When foreigners sell treasuries, that's a warning bell. That's an alarm that says there must be a shortage of dollars around the rest of the world, because here are foreigners selling their treasuries. Not because they fear inflation or they fear the dollar's going down to zero, because they're confronted with an immediate liquidity problem in the Eurodollar market that they face, that they usually try to circumvent or bypass historically mobilizing their reserves. And what we've seen from the tick data, which keeps track of this stuff, is that over the last half of last year, there's been outright selling in three out of the, what was it, 5 months of the last part of up to the data up to October. We haven't got to November yet, but
so net selling by foreign entities.
Right, which is huge alarm bells that go off saying there's more likely a dollar shortage in the global U.S. dollar marketplace than anything like an inflationary runaway that you hear about that's been conflated with the CPI indexes. So the massive warning signs of liquidity problems, which you got to believe is one of the reasons why the curve has flattened out. They actually time up very well. So the long end of the yield curve started to flatten going back to February 24th last year. And a very prominent liquidity issue happened on February 24th. So the market is saying the probability of a fractured and of a fragile system experiencing a very severe spasm is one reason why we're not so sanguine about longer term prospects for growth and inflation. So these things all go together. They're all tied together as a probability spectrum that favors a downside case.
Yeah, let me play devil's advocate, because I think, in fact, some good friends of mine that you might know would say, well, Jeff, how can there be a dollar shortage outside of the United States, or maybe a dollar cash flow shortage outside of the United States, when the U.S. trade deficit is at all-time highs, meaning we're exporting more dollars than we ever have?
Because that's not how it works. And anybody who says otherwise doesn't understand it. It's the merchandise deficit that the U.S. has left itself into is not the primary source of dollars around the world. It's a misunderstanding of how the Eurodollar system actually works. The Eurodollar system is external anyway. The dollars are already outside the U.S. It does not matter if the U.S. has a surplus or deficit on its merchandise trade. What does matter is the banks that are operating outside the United States, if there is a drop in the merchandise deficit from the U.S., which means the U.S. is exporting fewer dollars, then if we had a healthy Eurodollar system, they would make up that shortfall, and they would be happy to do so because that would give them a profit opportunity of demand for dollars and a supply external, matching it with an external supply of dollars. So the fact that we're seeing a dollar shortage despite a huge merchandise deficit is an absolutely pretty clear signal that the banks operating in this in the offshore Eurodollar space are not are being actually very risk averse and are not supplying the dollars that they should.
Yeah, right. Okay, so I just want to unpack that so everyone's following what you're saying. So the dollars, let's say, that are being created, the majority of them outside of the United States, they're created by the banks lending them into existence. It's just like that example I always use where if you want to get a $500,000 loan to buy a house, when the bank gives you the loan for the $500,000, that's new dollars, new cash that did not exist before. So they've increased the quote unquote money supply, let's say. And this is the exact same way that dollars are created outside of the United States in the Euro dollar system.
So more created outside than inside. It's
way more, way more.
So much bigger. Yes.
Right. So let's just assume that this market that's creating dollars outside of the United States, that on any given month, because we'll look at the trade deficit in monthly terms, let's say that the global dollars being created on net balance in any given month has decreased by $1 trillion because the banks are more apprehensive. They're more risk averse. They see the global economy slowing down. They're worried about those people or those entities that they may lend to. While at the same time, the U.S. trade deficit is at all time highs, but the U.S. trade deficit is only at $100 billion. So let's just say that those $100 billion in cash flow getting outside the United States, but that's being completely overwhelmed by that month, $1 trillion on net balance fewer being created by the Euro dollar banks themselves. Am I understanding it correctly?
You've got it. I would just add the caveat that it's more surreptitious than that, which means that it doesn't necessarily mean that dollars are contracting. We live in a nonlinear world, which means rate of change is everything. So if the global marketplace needs the Euro dollar system to expand by 10%, let's say, I'm just throwing numbers out here. These are not realistic numbers. So the Euro dollar system needs to expand by 10% just to maintain a certain level of economic output, and it only grows by 5%. That's an enormous contraction. So even though the Euro dollar system is still expanding, it's not creating enough dollars. And so it doesn't necessarily have to contract, but and it doesn't, and you know, and the other part of it too is it's not necessarily that, okay, the Euro dollar, we need 10% growth out of the Euro dollar system, but we also need 10% growth out of the Euro dollar system at the same costs as we've been using before. So maybe this year, the Euro dollar system will expand by 10%, but it'll cost you a lot more to acquire that 10% growth in monetary and credit resources. So that's another way in which the sort of hidden angle of contraction, which is that, you know, we don't need the outright, you know, all of these numbers to go down. We just need them to not grow as fast as the economy actually needs. And that becomes a drag, that becomes an impediment. And your point is exactly right, George, because the Eurodollar system is exponentially, it's orders of magnitude larger than the merchandise system because it, in the last half of its you know, growth existence, it wasn't so much focused on financing merchandise trade, which is where it started out as it much as is this, these financial flows all over, the hot money, whatever you want to call it, that goes all around the world. Where are these trillions that come, that where did these trillions come from that foreigners were using to buy up U.S. Treasuries, the reserve assets? That was Eurodollar expansion.
Right.
So the Eurodollar system is comprehensive in a way that the merchandise deficit is just a small subset of it.
Okay, let's kind of back up a little bit. I know something that's on most people's mind, at least most people that went to Rebel Capitalist Live and a lot of the speakers, is they're trying to figure out, okay, we get it. The Fed is telling us they're going to take, they're going to taper. They're going to go down to zero. They're also going to raise rates 3 times. But now they're also telling us, per the Fed minutes, that they're thinking about doing quantitative tightening. So I think this is why the market fell out of bed the other day. That kind of caught them off sides a bit. But my question for you is, how many do you think that they can get tapering down to zero? If so, do you think they can raise rates 3 times? If so, do you think they can actually do quantitative tightening without getting a disorderly, let's say, collapse
in the stock market like we saw in like March of 2020.
Yeah, to be clear, you know, to me, in the real economy, in the Eurodollar system, the real monetary system, quantitative easing, quantitative tightening, tapering, rate hikes, none of these things actually matter. These are all psychological signals that the Fed is trying to send to you and me and our employers and businesses around the world to make them do what the Fed wants them to do. Now, where that becomes sort of an issue in terms of finance and assets is stocks, because stocks have shown themselves to be incredibly susceptible to these psychological signals. But I would say that if you go back to 2017 and early 2018 with quantitative tightening, the stock market received the quantitative tightening signal very positively, very favorably. Why? Mm-hmm. Because the Fed was saying, we're so confident in the economy and the robust opportunities that are involved here that we've created for successful monetary policy that we're actually going to shrink our balance sheet. That's how positive and confident we are. And the stock market said, yes, this is great. We love this because the Fed is so confident they're doing tightening on their balance sheet. That must be awesome. So if we get into a situation where that's still plausible, like late 2017, where the economy at least looks like it could possibly get better, the stock market could look at quantitative tightening and say, this is great. The Fed is so confident that it's actually shrinking its balance sheet, that we don't need the Fed anymore. How great is that? That could actually happen. But there's also the other possibility where you get into the 2018-2019 scenario where the Fed is still incredibly confident doing quantitative tightening, and the marketplace says, wait a minute, this doesn't match what we're seeing in reality. So these signals are all getting crossed up. And of course, what happened was the Fed stopped its quantitative tightening way earlier than anticipated. That was July of 2019, and then started with rate cuts. So it could get to the point where in between there, the stock market looks at quantitative tightening and says, this is great, but wait a minute, maybe it's not. And the Fed is just going to do what the Fed does anyway until it's too hard for them to ignore any other scenario.
Got it. So maybe a better question would be, based on what you're seeing in the curve with the treasuries, how far does the market, what is the bond market, the smart money telling us as far as how many interest rate hikes we'll see from the Fed and if they'll actually get to quantitative tightening?
Yeah, I think you have to separate rate hikes from the balance sheet size, because even the Fed would tell you those are two different things. But I get, you know, I know what you're saying, George, and it's a legitimate question for people from, you know, looking at it from the outside. What is all of these things going to mean to the stock market or, you know, asset classes like gold or anything else? And the answer is we don't really know yet. I mean, the bond market, part of the flattening that's going on in the curve right now is the bond market at the front end saying, we're trying to get a handle on just how many rate hikes. And we don't really see exactly where the termination point is yet because it's still really early in the process. And you think about how the rate hike cycle went 3 and 4 years ago, 2017 into 2018, there was quite a lot of uncertainty there too, where short-term rates moved up in fits and starts. And it wasn't just, okay, we've seen where this all ends. It's really about probability distributions. And the probability distributions at the front end are, the Fed has a pretty clear path to do several rate hikes. And probably while it's doing those rate hikes, it's going to change its balance sheet composition anyway, because it has to send out these signals, or it believes it has to send out these signals. Whereas the long end is saying, okay, we see the Fed's going to do the rate hikes, but we don't agree with the reasons for it. So we think there's a higher probability of a downside case. We don't see anything specific right now that tells us when or how much or any you know, definable characteristics of what that looks like just yet, just that the probabilities are tipping in that direction. That's the flattening curve, where the long end of the curve is saying the probabilities of a downside case over time are rising. So that's really all we know at this point, is that long end of the curve, downside case probability is going up. Front of the curve, you know, it's clear sailing for Fed and the Fed's rate hikes and hawkish policies up and down the line for the foreseeable future.
Does the Eurodollar future curve give us any insight as to how far the Fed will get? Because I did a video on what you and Emil were talking about with the inversion in the curve starting, I think, 2024, extending out to 2026. And prior to that, I saw rates getting up to 1.75. So is that the Eurodollar market telling us that they think the Fed will get that high?
Well, the curve is uninverted, but it's still kinked, which means that there's a lower probability of that happening relative to what we're seeing back in early December.
Right.
But you don't want to take Eurodollar futures literally. You don't want to, you know, get the price and say, this is 1.75. Again, this is all about probability distributions. What the market was saying is that the Fed is likely going to do some number of rate hikes, something greater than zero, but less than, say, 5 or 6. Okay, so that was the probability distribution that the market was looking at. And right now, with the Omicron fears fading and market action in the front of the Treasury curve and other curves around the world, Germany, Japan, every place else, in January 2022, the euro dollar futures market is saying that the probability of the Fed doing maybe another extra rate hike or two has gone up, which matches what we're seeing in the yield curve, because that's the front of the marketplace saying that Omicron was sort of the last hurdle before Jay Powell gets to that termination point where he can no longer ignore the downside case. So if Omicron is the only thing in Jay Powell's mind stopping him from hiking rates, that's no longer on the table. So they're going to be able to go for some period of time. And remember, you know, the yield curve flattened out in 2017 and 2018, and the Fed kept going right up until December of 2018. So that was almost like a year and a half where the Fed continued to go before it finally said, oh, yeah, we made a mistake here.
All right, Jeff, I know we've gone almost an hour, and that was such a great conversation. Thank you very much, because you cleared up a lot of the things that I was questioning and I was having a hard time figuring out. I'm sure you did that for everyone on the live stream. I know you thought this would be the most boring conversation in human history.
I'm still not convinced it wasn't.
But no, we have got, right now we've got 813 people on the live stream. So this is probably another one of our videos. We'll get 30, 40, 50,000 views. You know, that's good though, George.
I mean, I think that speaks to both your audience and your own what you bring to the table here. Because if people are that much interested in software and library, that's a huge. I mean, that's very encouraging to me, because people should be paying attention to these things, because they're very important. Not in the way that you hear about, but they're very important. And as we said, uncertainty. You know, all of the backdoor stuff or what's going on behind the scenes and. People taking an interest is a positive thing.
Absolutely. You know, maybe one final question, just to try to give the viewers something tangible as far as a takeaway, is based on our discussion, how can they implement this in their own portfolio? And what's going through my head is there's probably nothing specific, but they can just, by understanding what we're talking about, it can help them assess future risk probably a lot better. Is that accurate, or how, what would you tell them?
Yeah, I think what we're saying is that we started out, you know, the risks are changing. We don't really have a good handle on exactly what that means yet. But what we're seeing is, you know, back in the start of 2021, it was like everything was good. Everything was positive. We had vaccines being developed. We had massive stimulus all over the place. And it seemed like, okay, maybe there would be an end of the pandemic and we would have actual legit economic recovery.
Right.
But we start out 2022 with all of these clouds of suspicion that have only grown larger and wider and fatter all over the place. We're saying, okay, all of that promise that started out in 2021, a lot of it maybe never happened. Maybe it wasn't even real to begin with. And now we're looking at 2022 in a very different light than we did it in 2021. And that can mean a whole lot of things. But for one thing that we should be looking at, okay, yes, the Federal Reserve is going to hike rates, and how the stock market, for example, interprets those rate hikes can mean a lot of different things, and those are very important things. But number two, the yield curve is sending all these negative signals where we need to pay attention to a downside case. Don't know exactly what that is or when, but we need to at least have that on our radar screen moving forward.
Makes sense. Okay. In fact, that's the name of your podcast, is Making Sense. So can you just kind of tell everyone where they can find out about the podcast and your content, your blog? And I think you write for Real Clear Markets. Just tell them where they can go to find out more about what you do.
Yeah, I do a weekly column, deep dive, as you just said, at Real Clear Markets. It's a fairly long essay each week. I'm published on Fridays, realclearmarkets.com. You find it there. I do all my regular posting at my company, Alhambra Investments. The blog is alhambrapartners.com. Usually do the same kind of things that we're talking about here. You'll see several articles on sulfur. So if you need a cure for insomnia, you can go there. We talk about Eurodollar futures and economic stuff as well. And then our podcast, and Emil Kalinowski, who is probably the better part of he really is the better part of the podcast. So we talk about these things and try to do as deep a dive as we can. We talk about, I think this week we're going to be talking about tick data. We're going to talk about BIS derivatives data, you know, really exciting stuff about what's really going on in the deep inside the bowels of the Eurodollar system, which is why we call it Eurodollar University. It's our attempt to try to illuminate and educate as much as we can about what really happens in the monetary system. And it's a tall order simply because what we've been taught and told from the very beginning is not how it actually works.
That's right. All right, Jeff, thanks for your time. I just can't wait to have another conversation.
Always a pleasure, George.